Welcome back to the program. Creative destruction, while it may destroy and reshape companies, is an ongoing process. We all remember the earliest days of pay-per-view movies, which begat home video and the VCR, which gave rise to the quaint local video store, which gave us Blockbuster and Hollywood Video. Then the DVD made these spaces even more abundant. And then Netflix made video rental easier. No late fees, door-to-door service, and curation, suggestions, and interaction. Now it seems that Netflix itself is under siege. Digital delivery has replaced the DVD rental model, and we're still seeing how this is all going to play out. We're going to take a look at this history of Netflix today with my guest, Gina Keating. She's covered media, law, and government as a staff writer for Reuters and UPI. The Greater Los Angeles Press Club named her its Print Journalist of the Year in 2001. She's also covered the Texas Legislature, Business, and Culture as a freelance writer for the Austin American Statesman and the Associated Press. It is my pleasure to welcome Gina Keating here to talk about her new book, Netflixed, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. Gina Keating, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. You know, one of the things about Netflix that's so interesting, and it's true of so much of technology today, I suppose, is that it's something that seems like it's been with us forever, and yet it's only really been with us since 1997. And one of the things you talk about is the founding of Netflix, the origin story, so to speak. Let's begin there.
Yeah, that was such a surprise to me. I started covering Netflix in 2004, and the only person I had ever associated with its founding was Reed Hastings, and I'd interviewed him a lot. I never suspected that that he didn't do the whole thing, but when I went back to figure out more about the company, I discovered this guy Mark Randolph, and went to meet with him and was shocked at the amount of input that he had into the consumer interface. He's a marketing guy, and as I drew the story out from the rest of the founding team, I realized how incredibly important he was to the company. I mean, Reed Hastings is a brilliant mathematician. Mark Randolph is the guy that made the brand that we love.
And yet it's interesting how often that is the case with so many Silicon Valley startups. We simply don't talk about Steve Wozniak as much. We don't talk about all those people that were roommates with Mark Zuckerberg.
Exactly, and I think, you know, with a company like Netflix, and especially facing what they faced with Blockbuster and now with the cable companies, you need a strong executive who is going to make the hard decisions and really focus the company. Mark Randolph is an incredibly creative man and a visionary, and his idea of wanting to connect with consumers on a very intimate level was what really made Netflix what it is. The consumer interface, the conversation that we have with that company and that website really were his idea. He was a direct marketing guy, and he had been around since, you know, catalog days, and he saw the Internet as a way to have this conversation constantly with customers and to get this feedback and to adjust the sales offering and the website so that he could create this environment that people would feel as comfortable online as they did in a store. That was really kind of a revolutionary concept, and his mantra was that the technology really had to serve the consumer in every way.
In many ways, it was antithetical to what went on in these stores, which had become larger and impersonal and didn't have people in them necessarily, unlike the early quaint video stores that one could get information from or recommendations from. It was really that idea of being able to curate what was there that was one of the things that drove Netflix.
Yes, exactly. And if you remember back in the early days of Blockbuster and the mom-and-pop video stores, what we loved about those places was what you mentioned. You could go in and you knew the clerk and you would have a conversation with them about the movie you just returned. And they would recommend something else because those guys were usually, huge film aficionados. And as Blockbuster got large, you know, you just hired a high school kids. I mean, I talk about this in the book as well. One of the Blockbuster executives actually had worked as a clerk in a Blockbuster store when he was a kid, and it had changed a lot around him. And they lost something in that way that Netflix realized, and with its recommendation algorithm, it continued to create that same atmosphere. I mean, Mitch Lowe, who was one of the founders of Redbox, was actually really instrumental in coming up with the idea for this sort of virtual clerk, because he had a little chain of videos in Marin, and he had watched how his consumers interacted with different clerks, and he thought, well, we've got to have that on this website.
Talk a little bit about the problems that Netflix faced in getting its content and making its deals with the studios, in all that it had to do on that side, and both the good and the bad of Reed Hastings in that regard.
With Mitch Lowe, who had great relationships with the studios because he was the president of the Video Software Dealers Association, and they were really lucky to have him because he was transitioning the industry from VHS to DVD, and so he had a lot of, I mean, everybody loved Mitch Lowe. He's just a great guy, and he could really access a lot of the studio people that Netflix never would have been able to get to had it not been for him. Initially, you know, they were trying to get deals on DVDs because the inventory costs were pretty high, and people were like, nah, we're not going to do that. I mean, it's kind of interesting what you're doing, but it just took them a while to actually get people to notice that they were pushing the DVD format, and the studios wanted DVD to really catch on because they were tired of splitting their revenue with Blockbuster. So they thought, well, this is going to be a sell-through market. If we can get people to understand how great this format is through a service like Netflix, then maybe they'll buy more of these things. And that's really what got them the content deals that they needed on the DVD format. Was the studios were sort of using Netflix as a way to introduce consumers to DVD. So for physical DVDs, that's how that works. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're talking about the streaming deals, that's a totally different thing.
And we'll get to that. One of the things about the original business model of Netflix is that on the surface, and you talk about this, it looked so easy, and yet others were not able to do it.
Yeah, the main thing that Netflix has, and this is all down to Mark Randolph and, you know, Reed Hastings for executing the vision that Mark Randolph had. Mark wanted to have a very instrumented market research platform as the website. So that interface that you go on to, I mean, hardly anybody has a queue anymore, but the website watches you, and they can, do different permutations of that website for every customer. They are constantly running market research studies on their consumers, changing the littlest things or the biggest things. And they've accumulated 15 years worth of data on consumers that they can use to project everything from demand to usage patterns, really everything. And that has given them a tremendous advantage because they see things coming in the industry that the media companies don't.
The other aspect is how much of their business, and this was surprising, just how much of their business comes from the back catalog?
70%, and it's always been that way. And it's a genius thing because, people always complain about how their content deals, with physical DVDs, they can't carry some of the first-run movies until 30 days after they are released. But I don't think they really care about that because, you know, they want to push people towards the back catalog. The economics of that are better for them. And the other thing is, you know, there's a discovery, a voyage of discovery with Netflix that we all really enjoy, I think, when you find something that's foreign or, you know, little known that you didn't even know existed, and you can sort of, you know, boast about that little gem to all of your friends and just be kind of excited that you found this thing that nobody else knows about.
Talk a little bit about the attempts to sell the company at various times and the interest in others in buying the company, deals that never really panned out.
Okay, that, I think maybe people might have seen the stories about the book from last week about Amazon trying to buy them back in about 1998. Jeff Bezos was wanting to get into streaming, and I mean, everybody pretty much knew that DVD by mail was going to be an intermediate stage. And he met with Mark Randolph and Reed Hastings in, it was probably 1998 or early 1999, and kind of made an offhand offer to buy it for around $12 million. And they decided, they didn't want to sell it because they thought they could do a little better than that. And then Blockbuster came in. Well, actually, they went to Blockbuster in about 2001, when they were trying to go public and the market had melted down in the dot-com bust, they weren't sure if they were going to be able to raise the money that they needed to keep the company going. And they went to Dallas and, Reed Hastings being Reed Hastings, confidently went in there with, you know, fewer than a million subscribers and said, yeah, you know, you can buy us for $50 million. And the Blockbuster people just thought that was ridiculous because, you know, they were small and, you know, internet companies were really out of favor, and they just it literally laughed in their faces. And I think that really fueled their desire to beat Blockbuster. That was one of the main reasons that they fought so hard against them, was because they felt like they really wanted to show them that they had been wrong.
We've talked, and you've mentioned Reed Hastings a few times, and certainly his reputation. Talk a little bit about who he is.
He is absolutely a fascinating character. I didn't know this, but his family was one of the, I wouldn't say Mayflower families, but they are really kind of out of an Edith Wharton novel. They're among the founding families of America. He grew up in Boston, and he had this great-grandfather named Alfred Loomis, who was one of the guys who was sort of indirectly responsible for the start of the Internet. He was a Wall Street financier and a mathematician who was one of the few people who managed to make money in the Wall Street crash of 29. And he used his fortune to create this amazing state-of-the-art lab in a mansion in Tuxedo Park, New York, which I thought was so incredibly interesting, especially because Reed Hastings was also an incredibly talented mathematician. So he was... You know, very personable to me every time I interviewed him, which probably I've interviewed him 20 or 30 times over the years. But I had no idea that among his staff he was rather feared as someone who really had no real concept of how to deal with people. You know, he's very focused, but people told me that he has, quote, an emotional IQ of zero. He's emotionally autistic, not in a mean-spirited way, but just, you know, he knew what he wanted to accomplish, and if you fit into those plans, then you got to stick around. If you did not, you were dismissed. And he didn't think too much about it.
How much of that personality and those personality traits played a role in some of the mistakes that Hastings would make as Netflix started to move towards digital?
As long as he had the executive staff around him that he started out with and that he managed to keep together for a good 10 years, he did well because there were checks and balances on that aspect of his personality. The tone deafness was mitigated by other people that were around him that wouldn't let him do that stuff. Also, you know, as he got more and more famous as a CEO and Netflix became more and more successful, I think he began to get a little bit of hubris in some of these decisions. You know, he had made a lot of incredibly difficult decisions as a CEO along the way, and he'd always been right. So when his executive team all started leaving in 2009, 2010, there was really nobody there to sort of tell him not to do the things that he did, like the price increase, which they needed and which was important. But the split up of Quixter into the two different businesses was absolutely awful and was totally self-serving of his own aims and not looking at consumers and what they wanted, which was extremely unusual for them.
What was his
something like that.
What was his relationship like with Wall Street since the company went public?
You know, that was one of the things I admired about him so much, because so many CEOs manage for Wall Street. You know, they'll manage their results to make sure that they get the numbers that Wall Street is expecting. He never did that. He was always focused on his business. I mean, he was, you know, never overtly, you know, gloating or anything like that, but he did what he wanted to do. He always was focused. He was extremely upfront about what the aims of his company were. In 2004, 2005, when he was trying to run off Amazon and Blockbuster, he made a very unpopular statement to me that he was going to run the company at break-even until as long as it took to run these guys off. And, of course, investors were just absolutely outraged if he would, you know, not give them back some profit. But he said, you know what, I'm managing this company for the long term. And, you know, if you don't like it, sell the stock. And they did. I mean, that stock went up and down a lot, and he never seemed to notice it, which I really admired.
How did people within the company, other stakeholders within the company, how did they respond to that?
It was extremely nerve-wracking for these people because we're talking about the employees, right?
Yes, executives. Yes.
they took, it's a very interesting compensation model they have. They're allowed to take their salary in cash and stock, and they get to choose how much cash and how much stock they get. And so, you know, most of them bought Netflix stock, and it was terrifying for them, you know, that it was so volatile. But it just speaks to his, you know, his power as a leader, that people just believed in him so much that they, you know, the employees continue to invest in the company. So, you know, they talked a lot about, you know, during the blockbuster years, just being incredibly nervous about what the future of the company was, and difficulty hiring people in who were not sure that they were going to make it.
As Blockbuster disappeared, Hollywood Video disappeared, the competition disappeared. What was the sense of success and even the sense of hubris within Netflix about what the future held?
In 2009, it became extremely clear that Blockbuster was never coming back. Jim Keyes had just taken the company on a path to, you know, self-destruction because of his emphasis on the store base. And it became very obvious that Netflix was going to win the battle for, movie rental. And really, you know, they were going to take it all. The video industry, store-based industry, was collapsing. It was a little unclear about what was going to happen next. I don't know that they knew they were going to take on cable the way that they did. But, I mean, they were ready. They had this concept of television watching as, you know, a very a la carte experience for people that would originate on the internet, where, you know, content would be liberated from these channels and the tiered cable. And that's what they were going for. I mean, it was kind of a pie in the sky thing, but now that they're at 30 million subscribers in 50 countries, it seems like it's sort of inevitable in a way, whether it's them or somebody else. That's what we're going for.
Who did they, after Blockbuster went away and the video store business essentially went away, who did they see as their competition?
You know, for a very short space, it was Redbox. And because Redbox actually was managing to cut into their revenue because mainly of the recession. You know, mm-hmm. People just didn't want to commit to a subscriber or a subscription model, so they were definitely taking business. But I don't think they see that anymore. I think even though Reed Hastings, you know, doesn't like to be real confrontational with cable companies, I think that that's who it is. He sees them, the cable providers who provide content, as his rivals. And, you know, he really, I think, in a way thinks, hey, you know, why don't you just move over and, you know, and use your pipes to just offer internet, you know, be internet service providers and let people like us do the content, because you just don't do it that well. It's another managed dissatisfaction situation where people just hate tiered cable. You know, they don't like the cable companies, and it's kind of another Blockbuster situation there.
But won't necessarily play out the same way. In many ways, Netflix and Hastings are squeezed between Comcast and the cable companies on one side, and a lot of pressure on the other side as well, from things like Hulu and other digital delivery platforms, and Amazon.
Right. Yeah. You know, Amazon gets a lot of play because of just the enormous number of people who go through that service every single day. I mean, they just have a lot of customers on their platform that they can expose to their video service. Reed talks a lot about use occasions, which is, you know, when I'm hungry for something and I'm not sure what I want. This is my analogy. You go to Netflix. You open the refrigerator. You see what's all in there. You know, you see what you like. You get a recommendation, and you sort of have an ongoing relationship with Netflix. You know what you want. You know, you've seen this movie come out, and you want to see that particular movie. So the use occasion is a one-time thing. You go to iTunes, you get it, and you watch it and pay for it once, and that's it. And same thing with Amazon, unless you have Amazon Prime. So I think they know enough about consumers to know that there's a large enough bandwidth of use for people to use all of these services. The content deals make it really kind of crazy because the studios are giving this stuff out piecemeal, so it's really frustrating, I think, for customers or consumers to find what they want. And I don't think that's really Netflix's fault. I think it makes it kind of hard to figure out who's going to be the main outlet. But I think that's just a function of the way that they have been assigning rights for, you know, a long time.
Right, because for savvy customers today, they don't know where their content they may want is, whether Amazon has it or Netflix has it or somebody else for that matter.
Right, and I think that the content is what's going to drive that. You know, once the studios figure out that they really just need to put the content somewhere and leave it there to make money, that I think it's going to be a little easier to predict who's going to win this battle. I mean, the thing that's a little disconcerting about Amazon Prime is that it's bundled with their shipping service, which is kind of weird to me, because how do you figure out who signs up for Amazon Prime? Are they signing up for it because it's cheaper shipping, or is it because they think that it's a better movie offering? You know, I just don't know. I don't think it's very clear because of the way that they structured it.
Their argument is that it puts people in a different relationship with Amazon, that it becomes kind of one-stop shopping for anything that you want to buy and have shipped, as well as for whatever movies you want to watch, or television for that matter.
You know, I mean, I don't think they really understand how people consume movies these days. I mean, back in the video store days, unless you knew what you wanted, you would go in there and you'd sort of browse the aisle, pick up the boxes, you know, and sort of make up your mind that way. And you can do that with Netflix because, you know, they are, it's almost like a store that you can walk in and browse. You don't do that on Amazon.
What keeps Reed Hastings up at night today?
I would say, the cost of the international expansion is going to keep him up, and also the content deals. You know, trying to secure a coherent set of content deals is a big deal for him. And I think a lot of it is just because he gets such bad press about the content deals. I think he worries a little bit about, you know, some of the other competitors that he has, but they're just so far ahead in terms of subscribers and data and experience, and, you know, you just can't discount those things. But I think probably the international markets is going to be the number one, just because, you know, they don't have as much data about that.
What about his relationship or fear of the cable companies?
I think that that is there, but it's funny. I see a lot of the same attitude towards the cable industry that he had toward Blockbuster. He has a really funny way of sort of downplaying Netflix's influence among larger rivals, at the same time as he's really working to undermine them. And he knows, I think, that he's got the same paradigm with the cable industry that he had with Blockbuster. People don't like the cable industry. The cable industry is being propped up by the studios. And that is, you know, the exact same recipe for disaster that happened with Blockbuster. So I think he's confident.
Gina Keating, the book is Netflixed, The Epic Battle for America's Eyeballs. It's just out from Penguin. Gina, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.